Sometimes the answers we seek are hiding much closer than they appear. You're listening to Western Worlds. Hello and welcome back for another conversation here on Western Worlds. My name is Raymond Francis, and I'm coming to you this week, as every week, from the Center for Planetary Science and Exploration at Western University in London, Ontario, Canada. The Earth's moon hangs quite obviously overhead, visible in its orbit nearly every day from most everywhere on Earth, its surface features plainly visible even to the naked eye. It's so close and so omnipresent that it features almost universally in human cultures and mythologies. But it's also tidally locked to the Earth, and so, as familiar as the near side may be, the far side was a complete mystery until the age of spaceflight. There's every indication that it hides the answers to a surprising array of questions about the Moon, the Earth, and the solar system itself. Deborah Hurwitz is a postdoctoral fellow at the Lunar and Planetary Institute in Houston, Texas. A specialist in planetary geology, she studies volcanic and impact features for clues to their origin and the nature of the processes that govern their formation. Recently, she's focused her efforts on a particular region of the lunar far side, an area whose ancient impact features may hold insights to what was happening in the inner solar system just as life arose on Earth. I spoke to Dr. Hurwitz at the Lunar and Planetary Science Conference in The Woodlands, Texas, about what lies on the far side of the moon and how we might explore it to find the answers it hides. So welcome to the program.
Thank you very much. It's great to be here.
Great. And you're presenting here at the conference, I saw, about a place on the moon called the South Pole Aitken Basin. Maybe you could introduce us to what this is.
Absolutely. It is the largest and oldest impact basin that scientists think that they've identified on the moon. It's on the lunar far side, so we don't actually see it from Earth. We have to use orbiting probes and orbiting cameras to take pictures of it and see it from space.
Okay. So being that it's on the lunar far side, when did we discover it? When was it found out?
It was actually discovered early in the 60s. 1960s, I believe, and they saw some scientists saw pictures of mountains on the near side. So it's near the South Pole, and you can see part of the rim on the near side in these huge mountains on the moon. And then when the Soviets started orbiting the moon, and then NASA followed shortly after, we actually were able to image the far side and then saw it. So it wasn't until the 1960s that it was first identified.
So it's a large depression then on the far side?
Yes, it has a depth of about 13 kilometers from rim to the base of the basin, so the bottom of the basin.
Okay, and you said it was among the oldest.
Yes.
How old is it?
Well, we don't know exactly how old it is. Some scientists have recently tried to estimate how old it is by counting the craters on the surface and estimating how many impacts we think happened early on in the solar system. Mm-hmm. And from some of those analyses, people think that it happened about 4.3 billion years ago. So way early in the solar system.
That is very old. Yeah.
It's very old, yes.
And how does that compare to the other large basins on the lunar near side?
The near side basins, scientists think that those stopped forming at about 3.8 billion years ago. So those are also very old, but not quite as old as the South Pole Aitken Basin.
This sounds almost as old, but I guess that's half a billion years newer.
Yes, that's still quite a chunk of time, yeah.
Yeah. Okay, and so what makes the South Pole Aitken Basin particularly interesting?
Well, like I said, we don't exactly know how old it is, but also we don't know a lot about the early solar system, what it was like. And this was the time when planets were forming. They were accreting out of smaller rocks that were crashing into each other, and some of those were sticking together and accreting to form the planets that we observe and study today. But we don't know how many impacts were happening exactly. It might have been significantly more than what we see today, or it might be somewhat similar to what we see today. So by figuring out the age of the South Pelican Basin, we can start to constrain a little bit more what that early solar system environment was like.
So if we actually knew how old it was, we could better interpret that crater counting.
Exactly, absolutely. And that crater counting is very important because we use it to determine the age of surfaces on all planets in the inner solar system. So going to Mars, people count craters and compare it to how many craters are on the moon and say, okay, well, we know how old some of the surfaces of the moon are. So that's how old a surface is on Mars.
Oh, okay. So the moon is like the reference standard for,
exactly,
for crater dating.
It's the only one that we have ground truth data. So astronauts went and picked up rocks and brought those back to Earth that scientists can actually figure out the age of those rocks. And then we can count the craters on that surface because we know how old that surface is. And that's the grounding for the crater counting.
So we're actually able to date those samples from the moon. And
exactly.
That's the standard for the rest of the solar system.
Exactly.
Okay. So then if we wanted to better study South Pelican, what's the next step? Is it to go get samples or?
I would argue that's one of the primary things that we need to do. We can study it from orbit. We can figure out what the composition of materials are, but we really can't figure out how old those rocks are until we go and pick up a sample and bring it back.
And it'll be from radioisotope dating, or how do?
Yes. Yeah. Yep. Geochemical analyses and radioisotope.
And we can't do that from orbit.
No. No, we can't.
Yeah. Okay. So we go to South Pole again, and we want to pick up samples.
Yes.
What samples do we pick?
Well, that's exactly what my research is trying to address. So what we need to find are rocks that formed when the impact happened, like during the impact event, and rocks that preserve that age of formation.
Right.
So those are the two key points. So what my research is doing is characterizing the rocks within the basin to figure out exactly which ones formed during the impact event, and then figuring out which ones are most likely to preserve that age.
So what kind of rocks form in an event like that?
Well, so it's complicated. It depends on what the target rock is. Mm-hmm. So when a large impact, this was an object something like 150 to 200 kilometers in diameter.
Okay.
When it hits the surface of the moon, it's going to eject a lot of material. Other scientists have done models that suggest that the upper 100 kilometers of the moon was completely removed from the basin. And that basically removes everything, all of the crust that we think is on the moon, or that we've seen on the moon. It removes all that material, and then it melts all of the lunar interior to a depth of about 250 kilometers. So this is
250 kilometers deep, it's melting material.
Exactly. 100% melting. Everything, the shock going through the rock is so intense, or going through the moon is so intense, that it completely melts everything in its path. And it's a lot of melt. And the melt then pools near the surface when everything kind of relaxes and calms down after the impact event. It all pools towards the surface in what modelers suggest is an impact melt lake or sea that is 50 kilometers deep. It's a lot of melt.
That is a lot of molten rock.
Yeah.
Yeah, and how big is the basin again?
So the basin itself is 2,200 to 2,400 kilometers in diameter. It's oblong.
Okay.
And the melt would have been concentrated near the center where all of this excavating was happening. It's called the transient crater. And inside the transient crater, that's where the melt sheet would be focused.
So something like 50 kilometers deep and
200 kilometers across.
Tremendous. Something.
A lot of melt.
Okay.
Yeah, a lot of melt.
And then that presumably solidifies after. So the moon is no longer liquid.
Right. Yeah. Exactly. So we see rock at the surface. It must have solidified over time.
Okay. And so those are the rocks we're looking for then?
So that's part of it. That's part of the story. A lot of the melt, so that's not all the melt that was formed. I mean, we're talking 250 kilometers of melting in this basin. Some of that melt was excavated also and redeposited outside that center portion, but still within the basin. So we see geochemical anomalies from orbit that suggest that there's an iron-rich material that extends throughout the South Pelican Basin. And I think that melt or that iron content or iron-enriched material is representing the impact melt.
Okay. That's the signature from the melt that got ejected to everywhere
yes,
around.
Yes, yes. Okay. And inside the center of the basin, there's even more of an iron enrichment, and I think that's representative of the material that solidified slowly.
Right.
And the material that solidified slowly may have differentiated, so formed a sequence of lithologies that we can only sample the uppermost part of because that's how deep subsequent right. impacts have hit in an excavated material.
Okay.
But that material, because it cooled slowly, would preserve the age of the melt sheet solidifying, not of the impact event.
Right. And that may have taken a while?
It probably took a long time, maybe 50 to 100 million years.
Okay.
I mean, we're talking an extended duration. It's when you look at it in solar system history, it's kind of short period of time, but 100 million,
100
years,
million
is a long
years
time.
Sounds like a long time.
It's
yeah.
a long time.
Yeah, and so if we were to get a date from that material, it would sort of be a young limit for the basin, not,
exactly.
not the age of the event itself.
Exactly.
Okay.
So what I'm arguing is that we want to go outside of that center portion of the basin, but still within South Polakan Basin, and pick up the quenched melt material.
Okay.
And that quenched melt would have frozen very, very quickly after the impact, and that would preserve the age of the impact event itself.
So this is the material that was, rather than sitting there in a huge pool slowly cooling, was ejected in blobs and landed places and froze quickly.
Exactly.
Okay.
Exactly.
So you're going to look around, maybe around the rim of the basin, or...?
Still, I would say still inside the basin,
yeah.
but closer to the rim.
Okay.
Yes. So one of the craters that or basins that I suggest going to is Schrodinger Basin,
mm-hmm.
and that's still a large basin, but not nearly as large as South Polakan.
Right.
But it formed after the South Polakan event, maybe closer to 3.8 billion years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And that might have excavated some material that preserves that quenched SPA melt material.
Okay. So it may have dug in and blown some of that original South Polakan material around.
Exactly.
Does it get confusing to tell the melt from Schrodinger to the melt from South Polakan to the...
It can, absolutely.
Yeah.
So that's why I'm still using that iron anomaly that I mentioned earlier.
Okay.
That is not throughout the Schrodinger Basin. It's only in one portion of the basin.
Okay.
So I would suggest going only where the iron content is higher than the surrounding areas and use that as kind of a representative signature of what the melt is.
Because that iron content should be connected to the deep excavation
exactly.
of the original large basin.
Exactly. Yes.
Okay. So how do you go get them? How do you go to these places?
Well, there are several ways to do it. There's sending a robot to collect the sample for you and send it home, or they're sending humans.
Okay.
And I would personally, of course, prefer to send a human.
Right.
I think that the efficiency of a mission with humans operating at the surface is far superior to a robot.
Okay.
And the instantaneous computing capability of a human to make decisions and figure out which rock they want to pick up is much better. But it can be done, I think. With a robot as well.
All right. And so have you got particular places that you think are excellent destinations? Or
I do. I do. So I've looked at the iron signature and mineralogy maps that other scientists have generated using the state-of-the-art moon mineralogy mapper, M-Cube data.
Mm-hmm.
And that data can look from orbit and figure out the precise mineralogy, so the composition of the material at the surface. And I look for material that matches the melt that I expect to come out of to have formed at the SPA impact event, South Polakan impact event. And I look for that material. And the best place, I think, to go would be the wall of Schrodinger Basin, because that's where you don't see that material getting ejected out of the basin. Everything that's ejected out of the basin, out of Schrodinger Basin,
yeah.
now is removed. But you can still see the wall. In the wall, you see the material that you would expect to be consistent with South Polakan melt.
So basically, where it's been dug down, you're looking at the edges of that.
Exactly.
Okay.
Yes.
And so maybe this is where the rock is an outcrop, and you can get it.
Exactly. Yes.
Okay. And have you narrowed down to individual sites, or still just kind of a general guidance?
Right. So I think I've chosen one site in particular that I think would be a perfect place to go. It's the southern wall of Schrodinger Basin. There's
yeah.
a series of terraces where the wall has kind of slumped down a little bit into the basin.
Okay.
And rocks that And you can see from the beautiful Lunar Reconnaissance Orbiter camera, the narrow angle camera, so LROC NAC images, you can see rocks in the wall. You can see them in outcrop. You can see boulders falling down the wall onto the floor below, and they leave these spectacularly preserved boulder tracks where the boulder just bounced along the surface in the loose lunar regolith, leaving behind these boulder tracks. So you can actually trace back the boulder to where it came from.
Oh, so you don't have to climb the cliff. You can just pick up the pieces at the bottom.
Yep, absolutely. And that's why a lander could potentially alone sample material that fell down from the walls, as well as samples material that's on the floor of the basin. So you can kind of compare those materials and make sure that they're different or see if they're the same, and just compare the composition of those materials.
Okay.
But if you have more extended capabilities with a rover, you could traverse up the side of the lower terraces a little ways and go sample actual outcrops as well.
Okay. Are there any other considerations that go into choosing a suitable site? You've talked about the accessibility of the science targets, but what else?
Absolutely. So there are quite a few engineering constraints as well. You can't have too many rocks in an area. You need a relatively flat, smooth area to land safely. But you can also, you can't have too steep a slope.
Right.
So the Lunar Orbiter Laser Altimeter, LOLA data, gives you very precise topography data, elevation data for the surface. And I measured the traverse, so I've proposed a 5 kilometer long traverse for a rover to go up about an average of 10 degree slope. And the Curiosity rover, for example, currently roving around Mars, can traverse up slopes actually quite a little bit more, well, steeper. So the Curiosity rover can traverse steeper slopes than the 10 degrees. So we have the capabilities for rovers to traverse such
slopes. So it seems like a promising site.
Absolutely, yeah.
So are we ready to go there, or what do we need to do before we could mount a mission like that?
Well, we still don't have landing capabilities to the moon, to the lunar surface, but I think people are working on it.
Yeah.
But even before we can land, we have to get out into space again. NASA doesn't have those capabilities currently, but they're working on it. Actually, I think in September, there's a scheduled launch of the new rocket system, the SLS, Space Launch System.
Right.
And it's supposed to launch an uncrewed Orion capsule, so that's where the crew would go, into space in September to test out the systems. And that's really exciting. If that test goes well, then we should be able to send humans to the lunar vicinity within the next 2 to 3 years.
Okay.
So we're getting there.
So the targets are there and the hardware and the infrastructure is coming.
Yes, exactly.
Great. Well, thanks for introducing us to this part of the moon and for talking to us today.
Absolutely. It was my pleasure.
You're listening to Western Worlds. Let's go to the discussion.
I think that's actually particularly interesting research to do, to spend your time trying to find interesting places to study the moon in situ.
Yeah, I like the idea of just looking at pictures to find a place to, you know, get your rocks from, or send, you know, rovers to where to pick up your rocks from, and like what you would learn from it.
Yeah, and it's like it's end-to-end integration of, you know, large-scale understanding the history of the solar system, looking at remote sensing, and then right down to picking individual places where boulders are rolling around and where might be safe to land. I think that's a really interesting mix of things to have to think about in a single project.
And I think that can, just getting that as a sample return or sending, you know, astronauts there to pick up stuff, I think that is a really neat idea of just doing it at a smaller scale before we go on to move on to Mars to do it, because really this is very close. You know, things can go wrong, yes, but you know, it's 3 days away, right? Yeah.
And it's very interesting what the potential, what the answers you'll get from that, from going there, but also perhaps there'll be even more questions that will be answered by going there and retrieving those samples, especially regarding the reasoning behind that. So that's also very interesting as well.
I expect so. I think, because South Pole Lichen, unlike a lot of the more recent impact craters that we see on the Earth, has been, you know, it's been bombarded for 4 billion years by subsequent impacts. So everything is going to be mixed up there.
Mm.
And if you try and find impact melt, identifying which impact melt was formed by the original impact and which was from a subsequent rework, that's going to be very complicated.
I think this is going to be, this could be the beginning of a very long sequence of research in that area,
mm-hmm.
because of the reasons you've just mentioned. My feeling is it's just going to lead to more and more questions, and you're going to need to go and get more samples to confirm results that you get the first time around. So it's very, very interesting and could lead to a long sort of a dynasty of exploration in that area.
Okay. Yeah.
She mentioned a number of different formation scenarios. It wasn't clear to me how the data that they would get would clearly distinguish between them. The deep melts and the impact or ponds, and whether it's just exposed crystals from below the crust that are being exposed.
I think that is a very difficult distinction to make in the real world. Here at Western, we did some field work up in northern Labrador in one of the sites that's probably most similar on Earth to what's on the Moon, the Mistassin Lake impact crater. And there's impact melt. There's a huge outcrop of impact melt that incorporates some anorthosite even, which we find on the Moon a lot. And the team actually put a lot of discussion and debate into trying to decide whether it was part of a melt sheet or just an isolated pond. It's really hard because, especially now that it's been eroded, everything else around it away, it's very challenging.
And I think that's one of the main reasons, like, why she was saying it would be better if she goes instead of sending it over or having a sample return mission.
Mm-hmm.
Because then, you know, you can go around and then they would know what to pick.
Mm-hmm.
Because they could, just by looking at it, distinguish, you know, whether this is a leftover of the impact or, like, the melts, or whether it's something different. So I guess, you know, having an eye would be better than rover
yeah.
trying to pick, you know, samples.
And I think what that eye is for is to look at the context of whatever you're finding. Is, you know,
yeah.
is yes, it looks chemically like impact melt, but is it surrounded by more impact melt, or is it incorporated into some brecciated material, or is it sitting loose on the bottom of a crater, having flown in from who knows where?
I think this is this is always the difficulty of robotic missions, though. Obviously, it's always better to send a person, but there are obviously strict limitations to that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, though it's better to have a human eye there for context. That's something that's been a contention of all of the robotic missions, and then therefore nearly all the missions that have been sent out. So,
yeah,
perhaps there are reasonable answers to those kind of difficulties for the moment, at least.
Yeah, and as you know, as capable as those robots can be, and as much data as they might send back, and it's easier from the Moon than it is from Mars.
Yeah,
the ability of a human to just look over his shoulder and see something and notice something. And robots aren't real good at noticing things.
No,
there's ways we can make some progress there, but you know, recognizing, noticing, those are things that are hard to get robots to do. And reasoning in place and saying, oh, well, let me just step over this rock and go to that one. That's something, you know, if you send Deborah there, she can do.
Yeah.
And which even the most capable robots we have now are not going
to be able to do. They're not going to be able to. That is true.
Yeah. And the rovers are slow.
They are. Although humans in spacesuits are also...
They are.
But they are faster than the robots.
Yeah, I suppose so. Yeah.
What is the advantage of going to one of the more recent craters at the edge of the Aiken Basin? She was suggesting that not quite at the edge, but nearer the edge. Is she hoping to get some of the material that was originally on the surface? Is that?
I think when the craters, if a newer crater forms on an already formed crater, I guess it still digs out stuff that, you know, you would not see in the earlier formed crater. So I guess if you want to collect two different samples, you would want one from a newer crater and one from an older crater to see if they both are the same, or maybe underneath it's a different composition than what you see on the sheet right in the older one. I guess that's one of the main reasons why you would want to go to a newer crater.
Yeah, and with something that large as South Pole Lichen, where there's almost certainly been a differentiated melt sheet, I guess you're hoping to get different things towards the distal part of it than you would in the center.
When a body hits another body and causes a crater, the actual action of causing the crater causes material from underneath that to be discharged out.
Right.
So if you hit a crater that's already there,
mm-hmm.
then is it true, is it possible that you then have the possibility of getting a sample of stuff that's even deeper into the
yeah.
planetary core? So you may actually be able to sample different materials and get a better idea for what the composition of that body is as well.
Yeah, yeah. We've heard the idea of impact craters as nature's drills. Yeah,
that's probably quite appropriate.
Yeah.
Really. Yeah.
I think that's one of the main reasons why she said, you know, to have two different places, one where it's a newer crater while it's older. I think that's one of the main reasons, because you get to sample two different kinds, and I guess two different eras as well, as, you know, because if this was bombarded really early, when, you know, the moon was still warm and, you know, gooey, you know what it's right now, then you would have this differentiation which he was talking about. But if the new crater is very, very young, you wouldn't have the material that is being thrown out mixed with everything else as you would with, you know, the older craters.
Yeah.
I mean, in geology, the little that I know about geology, I know that at different stages in geological time, with a changing geological element, that different elements are present. And so when the moon is warmer, then perhaps the results of an impact would have a different chemical composition to an impact. Then you can also get a feel for the composition of over time is earlier, and you can tell whether an impact happened earlier in the history of a body.
Well, yeah, and in part due to the amount of relaxation and due to, you know, because of that differentiation, the different layers of stuff that you're hitting into. But I think also part of it is just that Schrödinger happens to be a nicely preserved basin. It happens to be kind of toward the edge of the South Pole Lichen, but it shows features that they're looking for. It has these iron-rich exposures on the surface and some spots that look like they might be nice for landing. So it sort of just has the two ingredients. So I think that's particularly why this is interesting to her.
That's our show for this week. Western Worlds is a production of the Center for Planetary Science and Exploration. Western Worlds was created by John Moores. This episode was produced by Parshati Patel and featured an interview by co-host Raymond Francis. Our roundtable discussion featured co-hosts Parshati Patel, Tony Martinez, John Kesey, and Raymond Francis. Our editors were Tony Martinez and Parshati Patel, and I'm Raymond Francis. Our theme music is Heliosheath by Sean Kim. You can continue the conversation online and listen to past episodes or learn more about Western Worlds by visiting our website at cpsx.uwo.ca/westernworlds. You can also email us at westernworlds@uwo.ca. On Twitter, we are @WWAFM, and on Facebook, we are facebook.com/westernworlds. On behalf of everyone here, I'd like to thank you for joining us tonight. I hope you can find world enough and time to join us again next week, right here on Western Worlds. Thank you.